Hey friends, welcome to another episode of The Wholehearted Leader. I am your host and guide, Lance Howard. I am honored to bring to you a phenomenal conversation with Brent Beshore, the founder of Permanent Equity, about kingdom flourishing and God's economy. Brent Beshore goes and buys businesses, not to strip it and flip it, but he buys businesses with the long view in mind, to impact generations and communities for years and decades to come. Now, if you're anything like me, I grew up in a small West Texas town, and I had no clue what venture capitalist was, private equity. So I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with Brent, hearing about how he even struggled with Excel spreadsheets and navigating buying his first business. Now, friends, if you find this conversation helpful, and if it shifts your paradigm around how you interact with money and how you begin to perceive money as a way that we can all begin to flourish, I would ask that you like, subscribe, and share this with a friend. Thank you for being here. Without further ado, here's my conversation with founder Brent Beshore of Permanent Equity. Well, Brent Beshore, I am honored to have you on the Wholehearted Leader today. And as we jump in, I'm going to do my best to give you a proper introduction. But to be honest and to be fair to myself and even my listeners, jumping into a conversation about venture capital and equity and private equity is new to me. So I'm definitely honored to have you on here. But Brent is the founder of Permanent Equity, and he has established himself as a faithful steward of primarily people, let's be honest, but also their most valuable resource of money, and maximizing that not only in the short term, but for the long term. So Brent, thank you for being here today. And as I know, but the listeners don't know, you have a new baby boy.
I do.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, it's our fourth. We've got three daughters, 9, 7, 5, and a brand new baby boy, Silas.
Man, that is amazing. So this is the first question. So you might get a little bit of slack. Everybody has the same first question. What was the last date that you and Erica went on? And what does that reveal about your leadership? So granted, like, right, pregnancy, life, a new baby, three girls, like, I totally get it. I've been there, that there's seasons like, oh man, it's been a long time since we had a date. But what was the last date you went on, and what does that reveal about your leadership?
Well, I don't know what it reveals about my leadership, but I did set up a tasting menu at our favorite restaurant for her birthday. And okay. That was, let's see here, a week and a half ago.
No kidding.
So, yeah.
Look at you, crushing it.
Well, trying to honor her. She's worth honoring.
Absolutely. But if you're going to peel back the layer just a little bit, what do you think that says about you and your leadership?
Well, I'm not sure what it says about my leadership. I think it means that I try to honor my wife and try to be make sure she knows that no matter what's happening in business or life or other friendships, that she's the number one relationship in my life. She's the most important person to me. She's the person who God gave me to be my compatible opposite. We did a personality testing together, and I had this moment where at the time she was pregnant, we looked at, you know, these attributes, and it was, you know, she went first and was like, you know, are you more the attributes on the left or the right? And she said, obviously the right, like no sane person would be the ones on the left. And I kind of like looked over at her and I was like, all of those are mine on the left. And she had this, you know, she had this look of terror. This like, oh my gosh, like who am I married to? So, you know, we are very different people, but, she's my best friend. And she's the most important person to me. And so I want to put my time and effort and honoring into the things that are most important to me.
That's good. That's good. So what assessment was it? I know I'm going to have an Enneagram question for you as an Enneagram 3 that you've been self-professed as. So was it Enneagram or was it something else? And if it was Enneagram, do you know what your wife is?
Yeah, well, so we've done Enneagram in the past. Yeah, I'm a 3 for sure, 3-4 when I'm unhealthy, 3-2 when I'm on the healthier side. She's almost evenly split between 1 and 9. So very different personality than mine. The actual test that we were doing then was Myers-Briggs. Sure. And then there's an overlay from a group called Giant, pioneered by Steve Cockrum. I don't know if you're familiar with Steve and his partner Jeremy, but they have something called 5 Voices, which sits on sort of on top of and helps decode the way that we show up. All personality tests are going to be wrong. They're just different lenses to look through to click over and see how we can maybe understand ourselves better. And for me, the biggest advantage to studying this stuff is just to be able to have empathy for others and to be able to see others more clearly. So
sure. I want to get into some of your founding story in a moment, but still setting the stage so people can kind of know who Brent is. So you're 40, 41. Last year you turned 40, but you also talk about in your shareholders report that is on y'all's website. Y'all's website's amazing with just valuable and generosity out the wazoo of just wealth of information. But in that, you talk about you kind of go on this new health journey, right? Share a little bit about the insight, what propelled you on this new health journey, and more in particular, like, what are you up to right now in terms of like becoming what you would call, fit and healthy and taking care of yourself?
Yeah. Well, so, man, this is, see, how much time do we have? I could go on for a long time on this topic. Turning 40, realizing your life's about half over, and realizing that the stuff you can get away with when you're younger, you just can't get away with as you get older. Right. For the longest time, so I was not a believer until my late 20s, early 30s. And I was maniacally focused on trying to get rich. The models I had in my life and what I'd seen, it looked like the way to exert control, to be okay, to be safe, was to get rich. And so I was hyper focused on that aspect for a very long time. As I became a believer and God started revealing the idolatry that wealth really had. I mean, I would say it's beyond wealth, it was even mammon, right? The idea in the Bible of just sort of the craving of control and the craving of comfort and isolation. The grip that maniacal focus had on me sort of loosened. But look, I had a lot of bad habits. I didn't work out for a decade. I tried to serve my family. And as you know, when you have young kids and you have a growing business and there's just not a lot of margin. And so I had to make sacrifices. And ultimately I made the sacrifice that I just wasn't going to pay attention to my health. I gained a bunch of weight. I wasn't feeling very good. And ultimately I said, hey, I got to get this together. So last year I made the promise to myself. I prayed about it a lot. I asked God to give me a freedom in that area that I'd never experienced before. I always struggled with food. And stuff starts happening when you pray about it. It's amazing.
Right.
God started unlocking quite a few doors. I didn't realize how much stuff was underneath the eating, right? It showed up as eating, but it was a soothing, it was a coping mechanism for stress and anxiety. And because let's be honest, food temporarily does make you feel good. It makes you feel better. It makes you feel taken care of. And so that was one of my primary ways in which I soothed myself. And so really revealed a lot of what was going on underneath the soothing. And, through the help of a counselor, a lot of great friends. I had a buddy of mine. I said this in the letter who, I used to always joke about me being a fat kid because I could get laughs. Right. And I've always cared deeply about hospitality. So the good and the bad of food has always been a interlocking combination for me. And so, I'd say with some matter of fact, he said, hey, you got to stop saying that. Like, that's an identity. and you're not a fat kid. And so, you know, it really required a new identity as, you know, am I going to be a temple for the Holy Spirit? Am I going to be fit and healthy in every aspect of my life? Or am I going to have an area of my life that I just, you know, sort of say, no, God, I'm not going to honor you with that area of my life. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to eat as much as I want to eat, you know, sorry. And so it was a process of surrender of this area of my life, and then just to see what God would do with it. And so had a friend who told me, his name's Shane Parrish, and we were chatting, and he said, hey, you know, I can't decide to work out 3 days a week. He said, I can only decide to work out every day. And he's like, if it's every day, then I don't have to think about it. I just do something active every day. And that really, for some reason, I mean, I think it was, again, Holy Spirit prompting me, really hit me. So it was a combination of, hey, I need to take this seriously, need to be active every day, no exceptions, and trying to really understand what was driving a lot of the need to overeat. So the change has been as dramatic and I would say as unexpected as it could possibly be. So I'm down, I don't know, 35 pounds of fat in about 17 months, 16 months now, and work out every day. I'm able to do things with my body that I wasn't able to do before. And I just so much more healthy. So all my biomarkers and everything, I got tested beforehand and, you know, halfway through, and I need to get actually retested here soon, but everything's moving in the right direction. And I mean, it comes down to really simple. I try to eat, you know, keep caloric intake reasonable. You know, I work out quite a bit. I've started to enjoy it. I try to eat high protein, and, that's really about it. Yeah. And it's just amazing what's changed.
Thank you. Thank you for your thoughtful response and your recent journey over the last 18 months. What are you finding that you actually enjoy, right? A lot of people are like, and I just hate working out, or I super love it. But there's a lot of people just who struggle with the mindset of like, just do something every day. Just get up and move your body. And right, like you're talking about, eat dense, nutritious foods and protein. And it's amazing how simple it really can be. So what are you finding that you actually enjoy doing right now?
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved to play tennis. I've started getting into pickleball. So I play that probably twice a week, once or twice a week. I lift 3 days a week, real heavy. I've got a trainer who I love and who pushes me. And I do not have the ability without a trainer to push my body as hard as I need to in the gym. And so I do that. And then I've gotten into running and biking and long walks. I'll get on conference calls instead of, you know, sitting in a chair. I have a standing desk, which I'm standing at right now. I do a lot of times I go do walking meetings and walking calls. And it's amazing how all that stuff compounds. It's incredible. It doesn't take much if you just get yourself in the mindset that just do something active. And once you get out there, your body wants to move. So it's the hardest part is just getting out there and doing something. And there's a lot of days when I say, hey, I don't feel like it. And I just say, hey, get outside and do 10 minutes. Just go walk for 10 minutes. And then I get outside and walk for 5 minutes, and then I start running. Yeah. And an hour later, I'm like, hey, this is great. I feel wonderful. So, it, you know, mind plays tricks on us. Just get out there and do something.
Yeah, yeah. The simplicity compounds itself over time, for sure.
Amen.
For sure. We're going to get into some of your story, your faith journey. And I have been just honored to be on the receiving end of being in the room with you at the Kinsman event, being connected with Peter, and then just diving really further into who you are and just what you're up to in the world. And I just want to say, thank you for being a wholehearted leader, wholehearted man, and what you're doing. And I hope other people will benefit from this conversation as well to gain insight on what it means to be a financial steward. Because I think for myself speaking, it has been tricky to figure out how to look at the world through a financial capital mindset growing up as a faithful Christian. Right? Because we've kind of muddied the waters of like, you can't go and earn a significant and good living for you and your family, right? You kind of have to be meek and humble and gentle. And so good money is only reserved for the selfish and ambitious people who drive their lives and their families into the ground. So I just want to say thank you for leading the way and, you know, what you're doing. So tell us more, going back to maybe your founding story when you were 24 and you had your first opportunity to buy a company. And granted, we're talking in very bite-sized parts of your story. 24, buying a company, pre-following of Christ, and then maybe your post-conversion of like what those two worlds were really like for Brent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, 24-year-old Brent, I woke up every day with sweaty palms and in an existential crisis. I mean, every single day of my life. My cortisol levels were unbelievably high. And I could just tell it was damaging my body, damaged relationships. I mean, look, when you're trying to build yourself into a god, and the whole world is screaming at you that you need to gather and gain as much as you can, and you know yourself and you know your failings, and you know this doesn't have to turn out the way it could, and you don't have, you know, you don't have much to stand on at that point. It feels like a knife fight. Feels like you're just trying to, you know, trying to get out of bed, not get stabbed, to get back into bed at night. And yeah, I didn't have any faith at that point. I used to make fun of Christians as worshiping the sky fairy. Yeah, so 24, had dropped out of law school, started a business. And that had, the first business went terribly. The second business went a little bit better, but not great. And, you know, I learned more in those couple years, first couple years of operating a business than, I mean, felt like it was like 15 years of experience, than 2 years. Everything possibly that could go wrong, employee issues, horrible situations, lawsuits, bad behavior. I mean, just, and by the way, bad behavior on my part too. Like this is not me casting aspersions. I was a hot mess. You know, look, when you're desperate to win, everyone is going to turn into a screwdriver around you. So an object to use, right? And, people become the means to your ends. And, yeah, I'm not proud of the way that I behaved towards some people, back then. Shoot, I'm not proud of how I behaved now towards some people still. Yeah, so I had a mutual acquaintance introduce me to a person who was trying to sell their business, had been left at the altar for kind of the second time. And I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never bought a business. And I just felt like I should go and talk to this guy. And so we talked, and long story short, ended up buying the business with an SBA loan, asked my newly married wife to sign a personal guarantee. She's a scientist. I had no idea what that was. And I was like, yeah, don't worry about it. Just sign it and move on. I mean, when I say I had no idea, I mean, I remember the lawyer I worked with said, hey, we need to do due diligence. And so I typed into Google due diligence. And I knew nothing. I mean, I knew absolutely nothing. 2 weeks before we closed on that first deal, I called up the seller and I said, hey, if you take all the money out of the business and I give you all my money, which is functionally what's going to happen, how do I make the first payroll? And he said, well, you got a line of credit, right? And I said, no, didn't get one of those. And he was like, well, how are you going to buy the business? And I was like, I'm not sure. I'm going to need you to leave money in the business and I'll pay you back later. And he was like, you got to be kidding me. He's like, no, that's not acceptable. And I said, okay, well, we got two choices here. Like, you can either give me the loan to bank payroll, that first payroll, or I can't close the deal. And he was like, fine. So he left the money in and it all worked out great. Like, you know, he got paid back with interest and everything's fine. But anyway, so I closed that first deal and man, I tell you what, you know, we almost immediately got sued. Weird situation. We found out there was a lot of just not great stuff going on. We were in the midst of renewing a big contract. It was hell. I mean, I felt like that from about 24 to about 29, I felt like I lived in hell. I would, you know, I would often cry on my way into work. I would try to get myself together and then present a strong face for everyone. But I was just an absolute wreck. I mean, you know, barely making payroll, never missed payroll, but barely making payroll. Yeah, I just, my I had a new marriage that was not going very well. Almost got divorced twice within the first, 4 years. And I really ended up, so make a long story short, that first acquisition went well. The other businesses started going well, started another company successfully. And all of a sudden, you know, if I was God, I had such an idol towards money and success. I would have smited me, right? If I was God, I would have taken it all away. I would have said, you know, you don't deserve anything. And God's so amazing. He's so gracious and kind. And that's ultimately what brought me to Christ, was just this unbelievable love and grace and kindness that I was shown when I deserved absolutely nothing. Right. And that's the story of the cross, right? I mean, this is the story that we all live who are followers of Jesus. But, you know, I ended up at 29 and we were 28th on the Inc. 500, fastest growing company in Missouri history. I was making real money and had almost no expenses, had real low expenses. And so stockpiling a bunch of cash, had decided that, you know, pursuing these small companies was a desire that I had, that I felt like we could really get good at. And at 29, I mean, I was invited to the White House for a special event with entrepreneurship to advise Obama on entrepreneurship policy, had made a couple other successful investments. Things were going great from the outside. I was married, beautiful wife who loved me, who was super smart. And I felt empty and just felt horrible inside. I felt just empty. And so that was the moment where I got it all. Like, you know, Jim Carrey has talked about, you know, I hope you get everything you hope and dream for. So you realize that's not the thing. God at an early age gave me the ability to get basically everything I ever wanted and more. And I was like, this doesn't satisfy at all. This doesn't fulfill me at all. And about that time, I started meeting people who were so different than me. And I just noticed, like, they had this clear difference of how they lived their life. They lived open-handedly and with love and care and kindness and generosity and all these things that I was like, they didn't have to manufacture it, right? It wasn't so they pat themselves on the back. And I would ask them, I'd say, you know, what, who are you? Like, what are you doing? And they say, oh, well, I follow Jesus. And I'd be like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. Oh, come on. It's gotta be something different than that. And they were like, do you know who Jesus is? And I was like, yeah. I grew up, you know, kind of around the church. And I know. And they were like, no, I don't think you do know. And, you know, slowly over time, God worked through those men and women to, they fed me a lot and gave me a bunch of books to read and a bunch of things that challenged me. And eventually God's love broke through and transformed everything, just changed everything.
Love it. Love it. What are you learning about yourself? You know, I mean, that's 11, 12 years ago, kind of some of that transformational story. What are you learning about yourself in this season in particular? Like, how do you know you're in alignment with Jesus and possibly out of alignment with him?
Yeah, great question. The interesting part of sanctification is that you become more and more aware of your brokenness. I am constantly becoming more aware of my brokenness and things that didn't used to bother me now bother me and to a degree that it amazes me. And so I think that the cross continues to get bigger and bigger for me, and the love and grace and just dependence upon God for everything. Put my trust in and reliance upon him. And so I know I'm God's. I don't doubt my salvation. I don't doubt in terms of being in alignment. You know, a good friend of mine says that I'm God's will until God checks me. And until I feel checked, I feel freedom. I feel freedom to go and to live and to love and to serve. I can tell you that I heard this recently on another podcast that my friend Chris Powers did with a wonderful gentleman named Jamie Winship, who wrote a book called Living Fearless, which I would recommend everyone read. But Jamie on that podcast said, negative emotions are an invitation from God for transformation. And that's one of the things I've really been trying to pay attention to recently, is when I have negative emotions, when I feel hurried, rushed, anxious, frustrated, clearly I'm buying into some alternate story, right? Because if I believe that the creator of the heavens and the earth, the creator of the universe, knitted me together in my mother's womb, loves me, sees me, knows me, I'm not only likes me enough to be like to rescue me out of, you know, out of literal hell, living hell that I was in, but also gave me the title of son of the Most High King. Like I'm adopted as family. Yeah. If that God also promises to work all things out for my good and his glory, that as Tim Keller said one time, he said, you know, God either gives us what we ask for or what we would have asked for had we known what he knows. Yeah. What in the world do I have to fear? Yeah. What do I have to fear? What do I have to hide? And here's the toughest one for me is, what do I have to gain? Like, I can't gain anything. So I feel like that the two sides that I'm really becoming more acutely aware of is I alternate between looking at life as a gift or as a gain. Yeah. And that really is what it comes down to. And if I'm in the mode of looking at life as gain, then people become objects. I become hyper-focused on winning. And life becomes stale and bland and not very enjoyable. And if life's a gift that I get to wake up every day and I've got these 10,000 blessings every single day, the air in my lungs, right? The sunshine, my children, I mean, all these things, I mean, literally 10,000 blessings. And oftentimes when I'm in the my false self, if you want to call it that, I'm focused on the couple things that I might worry may not happen, or that I worry I may don't have enough of, or that I want more of, instead of saying thank you for the 10,000 things I have. So I think this season's really a sweet season of unbelievable blessing and God continually working on me to show me the depth of my brokenness and that he's there to heal me. If he'll just, sure. All I have to do is tell them the truth and ask him to heal me, and he will.
Sure. Sure. Jamie Winship, and some of that negative emotion that you're talking about and trying to live fearlessly, right? That his work is incredible. And that's ultimately what you're saying is, like, if there's that low level of anxiety going on, whatever it is, right? Anxiety is not right or wrong. It's a gift that's actually trying to teach you something in this moment, right? So how do you use it as a gift to figure out, like, oh, I need to listen to the voice of the Father. The Father's intentions towards my heart are very, very good if I trust him, right? So I don't mean this as an Enneagram 3 question, but it is an Enneagram 3 question. Going back to your screwdriver comment of, like, everything, like, right, you're just using things, using people, right? Oftentimes, we all, whatever number we are, I mean, if we're operating out of our flesh, right, we're seeking something of our own accord or of our own desire. But Enneagram 3s oftentimes are out of touch with their heart, right? It's this performance. It's not right or wrong. It just is. So how have you learned, Brent, to be in touch with your heart?
Well, so, I don't think I've ever talked about this publicly before, but it's, I had a major breakthrough in this area. I've got an incredible counselor. It's a crazy God story how I ended up getting connected with her, but I do 3-hour sessions with her. And one of my deepest fears has always been that underneath all the masks, all the performance, right? This is definitely an Enneagram 3 thing. So for people who don't know Enneagram, 9 numbers, they're all kind of different personality types. And what they show you is what your unredeemed part of you is driving towards. What are your deepest fears? How do you think that you should perform or behave to make up for those fears? And so Enneagram 3s, we operate from a fear of shame. And we're trying to achieve things in order to make up for it. So from a very young age, I learned that I loved competition. I loved to win, and I loved other people to lose. It made me feel good. Classic Enneagram 3 behavior. And what we do in order to win is we put on these masks. So we pretend to be somebody who we're not. And we, after a while, you frankly, you don't know if you actually have a you underneath any of it. Sure. And so my deepest fear, I'd actually have nightmares about this, is that I would have all these masks removed and that there would be actually nothing underneath it. I remember one time telling my counselor, I said, I fear that I'm a sociopath. I fear that, I actually read quite a few, I've read two books on the topic from people who are sociopaths who actually wrote books. There was actually like kind of a weird slew of books from sociopaths who wrote about what it's like to be a sociopath. And, you know, I'd read these books and I'd be like, I don't really resonate with all of it, but a chunk of it I do. And the counselor was, she was so funny. She's like, well, I got good news for you. She's like, sociopaths don't ask that question. So congratulations. But we spent, you know, one session in particular, spent about 3 hours and dived into this question of what is underneath all of it. Because my fear, and this is the way the enemy works, is the enemy takes truth and twists it, right? Just a little bit, just twists a little bit. So my fear has always been there's nothing underneath all the masks. And that means there's nothing to me. And what God really revealed to me through this session and through prayer and just this beautiful foresight was that actually my fear is true. Underneath all of the masks I have is nothing but fountain of living water. So what's beautiful for me is whenever I can remove these pretend things, then I can remove these masks, the false selves that I put on because I'm trying to promote or protect myself, that the gospel springs up out of that. Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and generosity and self-control, all the fruit springs up out of that. And so the way I look now at my life is how can I just clear the masks and it's almost like there's this beautiful well of pure living water that's at the base of my soul. And then I just clutter it with stuff, right? With fears and anxieties and masks. And on a daily basis, how do I take those and surrender those and clean the well? When I'm able to do that, man, life is amazing. I get to go on an adventure with my father. I get to love and serve people. I get to acknowledge that in 100 years, no one's going to know my name. And that's wonderful because the king of the universe made me his son. It's good. Fantastic.
It's good.
And when it's all cluttered up, man, I am terrified and I've got to stand on all those things and I've got to hold on for dear life and I've got to prove myself and I've got to win and I got to beat people and I got to use people. And it really is to me just, it's the ancient path, it's the good way, or it's the path of destruction. And I can tell when I'm on each one now. And I think that's the greatest gift is continuing to have a deeper and deeper sensitivity to knowing if I'm on path or not.
That's good. That's a good word. When you're talking about being a well, right, and excavating that part of you, it reminds me of Larry Crabb's work about Inside Out and like that we're all digging our own wells, right, to varying degrees. But right, if we can tap into the true and only lasting source of the living water, the living life, and not cover that up, right, our soul begins to flourish in new ways. But that takes tremendous amount of work, right, that you're talking about meeting with a counselor and paying attention to your physical well-being and all these parts of our lives that we have to be willing to remove. And then all of a sudden it's like we become this beautiful vessel that God continues to use in profound ways. And so I want to ask you about, you know, from the world's perspective about some of those profound ways, you know, with permanent equity and what you're up to and what you're creating and just your mindset around, I think you said it as instead of a strip it and flip it mentality, like you're buying businesses for the long haul, for a legacy. So share with us a little bit more about permanent equity and some of the mission vision behind that and what you're up to.
Yeah, well, I would say like everything in my life, my marriage, my children, my health, it permanent equity is obviously a gift. I mean, when I tell the real story, I joke that I'm the Forrest Gump of private equity because most people laugh and they think I'm being self-deprecating. I'm actually really not. When I watch that movie, Forrest Gump, it really does remind me of my life and my career because I've never taken a finance class in my life. I can barely open up Excel. I've never worked at another firm. I had no idea. I bought that first business and I remember a buddy saying, oh, you did a private equity deal. I didn't have any idea what private equity was. No one had ever told me what private equity was. So I literally Googled private equity and I was like, wow, look at that. There's a whole industry that buys businesses. Who knew? So permanent equity is really just a gift that I've received, and it, I feel like the vision for it came in sort of over time and has changed over time. But at the end of the day, what we do is we buy businesses with no intention of selling them. We use typically no debt in our transactions. We try to treat people really great long term, and try to all win together. So that in many ways is the opposite of traditional private equity. So traditional private equity has a bad rap for a reason. And look, like, this shouldn't be surprising. I feel like that so many people, and it frustrates me. I used to do this too. So I'm not casting aspersions here, but it's like they say private equity, and it's like almost like tis tis, like, how dare you? How dare you treat people so poor? It's like, look, you're sitting at the nexus of a tremendous amount of authority and power and money. I don't know anyone, literally anyone, who's not been burned by that. So you have an entire industry that is given a tremendous amount of resources to steward. Now, they don't look at it as stewarding those resources. They look at it as their resources. That's a whole separate conversation we can have about how to think about this. But like, they're given a bunch of money to invest, and then they're told you have to generate a really high rate of return within a very short period of time. What do you think is going to happen? Like just logically, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think those people are going to be well-adjusted, normal people who just love people and are relaxed and enjoyable? No, you're going to get an unbelievable number of type A, greedy, competitive people. That's going to be the norm. And turns out hyper-competitive, greedy people on a short time frame are going to do terrible things to win. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Right. Yeah, yeah. So what we're trying to do is, and by the way, we have these same impulses, right? I think anybody, the only people who don't think that money is dangerous are people who've never had much.
Sure.
And by the way, people who don't have a lot of resources can be just as greedy as people who do have a lot of resources. It's not the, you know, having money is not the problem. It's the desire to be rich that's the problem, right? The desire for more. I have these same impulses. Right. And so what are we going to do? We're going to set up a system where it helps encourage the best parts of what God has for us and helps us put barriers and blocks up to the worst part. So the fact that I'm in an industry that it's difficult to sell something, it's very difficult to buy something, very, very difficult to sell something, serves me well. I have moments with every single deal where I've gotten on my knees and said, God, rescue me. Every single deal we've ever done. And I'm sure it won't stop. I mean, we have businesses right now that are doing well. We have businesses that are not doing well. You know, life's complicated. Life's messy. People make mistakes. People get sick. People get divorced. People you know, want to change careers. I mean, there's all kinds of this stuff going on. And we have 15 companies right now in the portfolio, and it's messy, right? And it's beautiful, and we're doing great. And but we want to structure things to where it gives us sort of bumpers or safeguards against the worst parts of our brokenness. And so for us, the structure is amazing. We have an incredibly aligned fee model with our investors, and we're grateful for it. And like I said, it's unique. It kind of came to me in a vision after I was challenged to do it. I don't want to, you know, over spiritualize it, but almost instantaneously, I knew what we should do. It didn't take a lot of work. And I think that's an example of just as a gift from God, and we're trying to help change the industry in some ways. I mean, you know, in order to be respected, you have to be good at what you do. And by the way, God wants us to do everything we can under the Lord. Right. And, sure. And so we want to serve him, and part of being a good investor is generating great returns. Now, how you generate great returns matters, and what you do with those great returns matters, but we want to be excellent at what we do. And so we want to acquire companies and help the people flourish. We want to help the companies flourish. We want to win over a long period of time. We want to serve the people that we're with. And so we think that creates a better return over time than the alternative.
Yeah, that's good. So you mentioned about purchasing companies, and you kind of have this statement about, you know, small business or loosely functioning disasters. One, just I'll mention it again, but go to Permanent Equity. Brent and his team has done a phenomenal job putting a wealth of resources up there on how to buy a business and just everything. Like my mind is curious about, right? Very similar to yourself. I grew up in small West Texas town, and I thought everybody was a small business owner. I had no idea about venture capital and private equity and all these amazing things out in the world. So not the functioning disaster side of it so much, but what would your wisdom be on maybe say the 15 companies that you're operating right now? What would your wisdom be to not be a small business that's a loosely functioning disaster?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, most businesses struggle or eventually fold, not by homicide, but by suicide. So it's not because a competitor, you know, outcompeted you, created a better widget. It's usually pride and greed and dysfunction that usually causes the major problems. And so the reason why these businesses are loosely functioning disasters is because of the people. When you get a, you know, everyone's messy and you get a bunch of messy people together and turns out it's a mess. And so the first place, if I'm a business owner, the first place I want to look is draw a circle around me and stay in that circle and worry about me first. It's so easy to say, oh, Johnny didn't do what he should have done. And Billy didn't do what he should have done. And Susie didn't do what she should have done. And, you know, I can't believe these people, blah, blah. Hey, take the plank out of your own eye. It'd be my advice. I rarely meet a business owner that is humble, open to feedback, genuinely wants to learn and grow, you know, is curious and kind and open. Those people make crazy amounts of money. Frankly, usually those people are so successful that we don't get access to them because we typically buy, you know, smaller businesses. I mean, if you have a continuous growth mindset and you're in a decent space in an industry, I mean, you're going to create a really big business. Like, God is going to bless that organization in ways that is astounding. And I mean, the hard truth is that the reason why businesses don't grow is because the leaders of them are keeping them back. That's it. And so pride's the problem. You know, sin's always the problem and Jesus is always the answer, right? Pride's the problem. Humility's the answer. And so how do you humble yourself before the Lord and say, hey, I want to get better. I want to be more whole and holy. And I want to know that I'm protected in you, Lord, so that I can be open to getting potentially harsh feedback and criticism from others. Yeah, that's really the key.
That's good. What industries do y'all focus on? And maybe even a broader question of like, hey, what industries should people be curious about? Or does it really go back to the people question? Like, maybe you're industry agnostic and it's like, hey, just find a good, healthy team and a good, healthy leader and go with that. Or are there places out there to say, hey, these are opportunities to be aware of that I know about?
Yeah, I would say there. So we're not industry specialists, but we are phase of company specialists. So we joke that we acquire adolescent businesses. So they're too big to be small, too small to be big. You know, we talk about this idea of the ceiling of brute force, where no matter what you do, you just keep bumping up into the ceiling where you feel like you can't get past it, can't grow past it. And so what we are able to do is to come in and help people maybe have different view, different talent access, access to capital, maybe some different risk tolerance than they're used to having, to be able to then, you know, break loose from some of these ceilings. And so, yeah, we're agnostic. We've got business services, manufacturing, construction. I mean, we're in aerospace. We're in, 15 companies are very, very broad. What I would say is that the commonality amongst all of them is there are a few things that are usually holding them back, these lids that are on the businesses that we're trying to release over time. And that can be very disruptive and very difficult. And oftentimes it's difficult because in order to change, you have to admit that you were wrong.
Sure.
And the hardest thing for people to do is to admit that they're wrong because they're so concerned with preserving their identity and self-image. Wow. And so, again, comes down to humility. We're trying to constantly be working with our leaders and with our teams to see truth. Not that we have a monopoly on truth. We're trying to understand from them as well what truth is, and then we're trying to learn and grow together.
Sure. So when you're trying to remove these lids from these companies and these leaders, are you going in with kingdom principles? Are you using tools, assessments? Like how does your process actually work and function? Trying to raise like emotional awareness and really kind of what we're talking about in this conversation, like, right, get at a heart level of like ultimately people flourishing around you. So what's the process actually kind of look like on that front?
Yeah, well, first, I think so. All good principles are kingdom principles. It's all there in the Bible. It's all sent from the Lord. So thank goodness for common grace, and you know, God lets the rain shine on the righteous and the wicked together, right? You know, in terms of we don't work exclusively with Christian business leaders. In fact, I would say 50%, maybe even less than 50% of our leaders are followers of Jesus. So we have a mentality. We don't think that Jesus just interacted with the religious people. We think that he came in contact with people of all kinds, the rich, the poor, the sinners, the people who are religious. We take all of them. So, and our team is not exclusively Christian either. We've got a pretty good diversity on our team. So, we are all sharing in common values, though, and we are very clear on what those values are. If you go to our website, you can see those, and those are all kingdom values. That, you know, most people are not ready to have the conversation that you and I are having today, and that I think that you're probably used to having. It takes a depth of emotional awareness. It takes an ability to see the way that most people are not there. And so what we try to do is we'll go as deep with people as they want, but we oftentimes are just trying to model behavior for them and model good decision-making and kindness and generosity in a way that is encouraging and is an aroma to them of something deeper. And so everything's a little bit different. I mean, we have best practices across all the kind of major parts that any business is going to need. So, you know, marketing, advertising, and sales, technology, accounting, finance, taxation, operations, support, HR, all these are different areas, and, you know, talent recruitment, that, you know, we have learned some things from seeing all the companies we've seen and from operating the business we're operating. And so we're trying to help them be leveling up in each one of those areas, at the same time deepening our trust and relationship with the leaders. And sometimes we do a great job and sometimes we don't. And sometimes things work out well, sometimes they don't. And just try to live in the imperfect reality that we have.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, I think that's amazing, right? That you're working with half of your 15 companies are not following in the way of Jesus, right? That just speaks on the value of actually what you're doing, like, right? Because on so many hands, right, the faith-driven entrepreneur mindset is like, oh, I'm going to go serve Christian CEOs. Well, what about those who are curious about the principles that you're talking about? Like, how do we serve them and invite them into this way of being and becoming a person that's attractive, but that's filled with love and joy and peace and all the things that we're talking about? So I think that's absolutely amazing. How does that happen? Like, because I mean, you're pretty forthright with your faith at this point. And you go to Permanent Equity and it's pretty forthright of who y'all are and what you're doing and who you're serving. Like, how does that intersect, or how does that integrate for you, that whole faith and work element and these people holding those two in tension?
Yeah, I mean, I would say everyone, I think, is aware of where I stand, and I'm always open to having a conversation. We also are not forcing the conversation. I mean, some of the best conversations, honestly, and this is where, you know, there is a wonderful purpose, and I want to encourage the people who say, hey, I have it on my heart that I want to serve the Christian devout believer who's an entrepreneur, CEO. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, and that's wonderful. I feel like that I've just been called into a different ministry, right? It's interesting, the people who to me are the most lost, it's like anything else, when you think you're humble is when you're really in danger, right? The people who are most in danger to me are, it's maybe like a horseshoe, right? Where on one side you have the, what I would call, like, cultural Christian. You know, C.S. Lewis says a little Christianity is an inoculation against Christ. And on the other side of the horseshoe, kind of all the way back around, are the people who are indifferent to God, in sort of just like, I'm agnostic. I don't really care. It's not really important to me. My life's fine. I don't see the need for God. Like, those two people are actually the furthest away, I think, from God. As you round up the other side of the horseshoe, it's really interesting because I found, and when I was closest to converting, when I was closest to actually starting to follow Jesus, was when I was most antagonistic to the faith. So if you look at, I mean, the Apostle Paul, right? If you look [S2] Sure. [S1] At a lot of these people, you know, it was the people who were impassioned and who were seeking, they just were on the wrong road and were frustrated and angry that they couldn't figure out what was going on, right? Those are the people who are primed to start following Jesus. So I tried to no longer, I've learned, like, people who I thought were never going to come to Christ, who were didn't want nothing to do with it. You sow the seed over there, you have no idea what's going to happen. I've seen people who I never would have guessed come to Christ. Yeah. I've also seen people who I was like, I thought for sure they were a shoe-in to like within a short period of time to start following Jesus, and they are more wayward now. And by the way, not wayward by the world standards, but wayward in terms of, you know, have no desire. So in terms of how we think about it is, I just want to sow seeds down. It's not my job to grow them. I have no idea. I can't decide the soil that they're going to fall on. And just to be a safe, non-judgmental place for people of whatever their faith is, whatever the conversation they want to have. Obviously, we all have a worldview. You know, to say that there is no God is definitely a worldview. To say that, you know, all religions lead to the same place. It's, you know, all climbing the same mountain to the top. That's a worldview. I disagree with that, but I mean, I'm happy to have the conversation anytime. And just, again, I told this somebody the other day, I said, people get the impression that somehow you get like brownie points with God or whatever for, you know, arguing the certain way or bringing somebody to Christ or whatever. I don't look at it that way at all. Like, it's not my job. It's the Holy Spirit's job. And God doesn't need to use me. Like, I want to be his hands and feet. I want to be a good steward of the time and talents and treasure and relationships he's given me. But look, like, I have no idea what the ramifications of my actions are going to be. All I can do is, again, draw a circle around me, try to be faithful, try to be humble, try to be surrendered in what I have, see what happens around me.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Brent, I want to honor your time. I'm sure you have a family to get back to and your day to get back to, but just thank you for today. Maybe just one or two questions to close our conversation out. I know you're a community builder, there in your local community in Missouri, and you're up to some other amazing things. Is there anything in particular that has your curiosity or your sense of like, this is important to me right now in this season that I'm kind of like pursuing?
It's an interesting timing for that conversation. I had a wonderful conversation with a dear friend on this topic yesterday. I mean, I'm super passionate about helping small companies transition. I mean, we want to serve families, we want to serve companies, we want to help people flourish. There's it's part of a broader mission, though. I feel called that God has given me an identity to help rescue what I would call kings. And this is something I don't think I've ever actually talked about publicly, but it's fresh on my mind is, you know, the only way you can rescue whole kingdoms is by rescuing kings. Now, we don't use that language anymore because we're democracies and, you know, Western forms of government and all this stuff. But practically, if you look at, you know, any region, any city, no matter how small, you're going to have leaders of it. You're going to have people who have more resources, authority, influence, money, power. Maybe it's official power, maybe it's unofficial, maybe it's soft power, maybe it's hard power, but you're going to have, you know, authority and power structures. Those are the kings, right? Those are the, you know, when we look at the days of old, you know, you have the sort of the king of the Roman Empire, right? You have the emperor, and then you have all these like little kings underneath them, right? That have all these provinces, and underneath them they have, you know, it's kings all the way down. You know, I'm very passionate about serving kings and queens. I met a guy recently who, unbelievable, wonderful guy who they have a group that they go into and rescue people in disaster zones. They rescue people in war-torn areas. They have incredible stories. They're all like trained. They're all, you know, ex-military and first responder trained and all that stuff. And I said, hey, look, I can barely change a light bulb. Like I'm not that guy. I have no idea. I took a CPR class in college. I probably need to brush up on it. I am not somebody who is going to be very useful going into like a war torn area and like doing whatever that needs to be done. Sure. But what I can do is I can serve kings and queens who are failing in their marriage, who are failing in their business, who are failing with their children, who are failing with their health, who are failing in their sexuality, because I've faced all these issues myself. And I've been on the losing side and I've been on the winning side, and I've seen God transform a lot of those areas of my life. And so, you know, I think that's an area that I'm passionate about, which wonderfully dovetails into what I do for a living. And that's what's amazing about how God works, right? Is if you look at these organizations that we're acquiring, they're little kingdoms. And the people who run them are kings and queens. And so we want to serve families that are the royal families of these businesses. And beyond that, even if we have no financial, interaction at all, relationship, I love serving people who are trying to navigate what does it look like to be a steward of a lot of resources, and how do I help them either get rescued out of peril or not fall into peril in the beginning. And like I said, from personal experience and from what I've observed, anytime anybody amasses any sort of money, fame, or power, any large leap in those areas, it's really dangerous. And when you think you're not in danger is when you end up having the falls. And I've just seen it over and over and over again. And it's tragic, and it destroys families and generations of families. And so that's an area that I'm really excited about. I'm passionate about. I'm trying to serve and through the convening that I do through some of these events, some public ones, some private ones, and then just try to be a resource to these men and women that are stewarding a lot and have a lot of responsibility and can feel that heavy weight and burden, and hopefully help them any way I can.
I love it. Love it. I know the mutual common language, so I can connect real quick that Morgan Snyder, Becoming a King, and his book and resource, actually, he'll be a guest tomorrow on the podcast, and that one will be out in several weeks or a couple months from now. But I just value, right, the seeking the restoration of allowing these people who have time, money, and talent, and significant amount of influence. How do you nurture them in a way that they possibly can adopt an eternal perspective as well? I love that mission. So speaking of kings, and you have the opportunity to raise a king, your newborn Silas. Congrats again. So when you look back, or let me ask it from this perspective, when Silas looks back at his dad, Brent, what do you want him to say?
It's a great question. I wanted to say that I loved him and I was there for him and I prioritized him. But I was wholehearted, trying to move my family, trying to lead my family well, and that I honored him and sacrificed for him. And hopefully that's an inspiration for him to do the same. I mean, look, every family has generational sin, and my family's no different. And I think it's one of the things I pray often is that God would help me to break patterns of generational sin. And so I want him to be successful in whatever that means, to steward well and to love the Lord, and that I was tender and open-hearted and patient with him, and in a way that was undeserved, because that is what I've gotten from the Lord. And hopefully I can rest secure in the undeserved grace that I've been given, and that I can extend that same grace and love, and that he sees a small, imperfect picture of the Father through his own Father. That'd be my hope.
That's good. Well, Brent, be sure, thank you for the gift of your time and your presence in this conversation today. It's truly been an honor and a blessing to host you.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. It means a lot to me that you'd have me on.
Absolutely. Thank you, friends, for being here today. My name is Lance Howard, business coach and leadership development for high-level faith-driven leaders. My goal is your flourishing, and my approach to developing executive leaders integrates the maximization of hope, gaining an outside perspective, devising practical strategies, and implementing measured discipline. This is all done with warm accountability aimed at achieving your desired outcomes. When you're making large financial decisions that impacts years of life, you need a trusted advisor to help guide you and to make a wise decision. What is executive business coaching? Effective coaching is pragmatic and outcome focused. It flows naturally according to your goals. It is conversational and rich with thought-provoking discussion. Pictured as a meaningful board meeting, an insightful chat with a close friend, a day of profound reflection, a session to recalibrate, and a stimulating brainstorming experience. It's both enjoyable and profound, tiring yet invigorating. Above all, it's having a trusted advisor right there beside you. My goal is your flourishing, to help you work less, earn more, and get back to what you love in life and in business. Now, when you're ready to have someone ride co-pilot with you on your leadership journey and business development, I would be honored to have a conversation with you to explore what it would look like for us to partner together for your flourishing. Peace and courage to you on your journey. I look forward to hearing from you soon.